Hello, and welcome to the Monthly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting some of the comics we got this month, a few from DC, a few from Marvel, and a few from some of the other publishers. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. In this monthly comic spotlight, I'm joined by James, and we're going to be discussing some of the comics we got in August 2026. James, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, John?
I am doing all right. Now, I read about 24 comics this time.
Oh, nice. Okay. And I read, believe it or not, a tiny bit less than that, but I seem to enjoy my mainstay of stuff that I kind of always enjoy, which is funny.
That's good.
I dip into other things to test it out, but a lot of times it's something like, nah, this isn't good.
Yeah, I read 24 comics. I think I could have chosen better.
Ah, so you were not happy necessarily with your choices.
I was not overjoyed. I was not upset either, because I kind of knew going in that a few of these were going to be, are they really going to be all that good?
Okay.
But I would have preferred if they were better, to be honest.
Yeah. One of the things I jumped into, it was, in my opinion, okay, but I wasn't that impressed with it. And then I heard that it was going to be ongoing, and I was like, wow, that just kind of surprised me a little bit. And we'll get to that.
All right. Well, do you want to just go ahead and give your first one?
Yeah. Okay. The new thing I tried, you know, there's the movie out, Brand New Day, Spider-Man, Brand New Day.
Yes.
I have not watched the movie. I have the omnibus story. I read issues here and there when it was coming out. I didn't read the whole saga, Brand New Day.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a new Spectacular Spider-Man Brand New Day by Dan Slott. So I read this on the Marvel Unlimited app. I thought, hey, the movie just came out. Let me see what this is about. And it is an ongoing now, so people really enjoyed it. And like I said, Dan Slott's on it, so he's a good writer. And especially for, I think, Spider-Man and Fantastic Four, he does a really good job with those properties.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. So it started off as a quick one-page retelling of the origin for new readers. How many new readers are there? Not very many, but I thought it was nice. It was kind of like an onboarding on-ramp. And then the first scene is with Wilson Fisk, the Kingpin. Spider-Man stole his ledger. Fisk has memory loss about things. And the past kind of unfolds with what happened all about that as the fight's going on. So he uses the fight and all the narrative in there to tell you what's going on if you're not familiar with this era of the Marvel Universe, because he's taking it back to the Brand New Day that happened in the past. And so, like, at the first, I'm like, I don't know what's going on. This is like around Civil War time and stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say that goes back a ways to Brand New Day.
Yeah, and my memory is not great anyway. So I thought for that going so far back, he did a good job of catching you up with the way they're talking. It's like, oh yeah, there's the memory loss. Oh yeah, he helped him with this. Okay, that makes sense. So I liked it. They did that in there. So I wasn't completely lost. And it worked, I thought. Doctor Strange made people forget that Spider-Man had revealed himself. I don't think that's a spoiler because we all read that way back when.
Well, that's the thing, is not everybody did.
Oh, okay.
Not everybody's read every comic, but we've got to get into a couple of the story aspects here. So yeah.
Exactly. So they did all that. And then you move on to Spider-Man fighting with the Magia, and you get some Frank Castle classic stuff going in there, which I like seeing Frank Castle and the Punisher the way he was versus sometimes the new riffs and takes that we get on the character.
Mm-hmm.
And then Peter goes with Aunt May to work on a project for the hungry and disadvantaged, this little community center. So it's just going through all these little tropes and things that are going on. And Peter's going to be doing some computer training at the community center. And then ultimately, it leads up to Spidey and the Punisher teaming up against a bad guy that overthrew the Magia. And that's going to be the next big bad that we're going to be dealing with. And I did think there was a nice twist at the end, I think, and it was a nice start to the series, but I was surprised that they're not just going to keep it a mini series or even maybe like a 12-issue maxi series that they're going to say, hey, this is ongoing. And maybe it's because it worked very well, because I thought this is like such a caption in time back there and not tying into anything Marvel's doing now that it can almost be a distraction to what's going on in Amazing Spider-Man, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the only thing that surprised me. But it was written well. I would have probably given it like a B, B plus, somewhere in that range.
So which issues did you read of it?
That's literally the first issue.
It's all the first issue. Wow.
Yeah, there was a lot. It was an oversized issue. There was a lot to it. it was oversized. So I'm assuming probably in the 52-page area is what I'm guessing. It doesn't tell you on the app, really, when you're reading how many pages, unless you go looking for it.
Right.
And so I was just reading it. I was like, oh, this is a lot of material. So I don't know how many pages. So what could have been 30, 40, could be 50. I honestly don't know.
Interesting. It sounds like they covered a lot of ground.
They did, and I did enjoy it. I think he did a good job of taking us back. You know how they did that with some of the X-Men books where the writer, Chris Claremont, would go back and revisit the world with those same characters?
Mm-hmm.
And he, in my opinion, didn't do a good job of getting you up to speed of what the heck's going on. He just is like, oh, here's the next issue, and here's this thing. And if you don't remember what was going on around that time, you're kind of lost.
Yeah, if you're going to do something that, particularly if it fits between existing issues of a title,
yeah,
kind of like the Untold Tales of Spider-Man that Kurt Busiek did way back in the day, you got to give us some clues if that's set 10, 15 years of publishing-wise earlier. Give us a little help as to what's going on. Put us back into that time and that frame of reference.
Yeah, I agree. So two thumbs up to Dan Slott for accessibility.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a good writer. And again, I agree. He's done really good on Spider-Man and Fantastic Four.
Yeah, that seems to be his bread and butter. Other people mentioned She-Hulk, and I agree. She-Hulk, he does well. But those two properties in particular, I think he just loves the characters and he writes them very well.
I think he did well on She-Hulk, but not to the level he did great on Spider-Man and Fantastic Four.
I agree. I concur.
All right, my turn?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, I'm going to go with Batman Superman World's Finest number 51 to 53. This is the Warlords arc.
Ah.
And it takes place in Skartaris, three-issue thing.
Ah.
And the basic setup is Superman, Batman, and Robin are following Travis Morgan's flight path after another pilot has gone on that path and gone missing.
Oh my God, another one. That's funny.
Things don't go as planned. And at first, Robin's like, well, why are we having to go? Superman could just do this on his own. It's like, well, we got to follow exactly the path.
Yes.
So that's why Batman and the Batplane are there and Robin's along for the ride. Again, things go squirrely. Superman ends up crashing down, as does the Batplane. So Batman and Robin have to eject. They all wind up in Skartaris, and dinosaurs ensue, and they quickly encounter Travis. And of course, Travis has no earthly idea who the hell those two are, or those three are, because he got into Skartaris before Superman and Batman became active.
Yep.
So it's like, okay, is a circus in town or whatever? And one of the decisions Mark Waid made that I thought was really clever was that there is, quote unquote, literally magic in the air, which really wrecks havoc with Superman's powers.
Ah, okay. All right. Gotcha.
So it's not suddenly he can just grab everybody and fly to wherever they need and all that kind of stuff.
The magic is affecting him, so he's a little bit limited.
Yeah.
All right.
So obviously we've got Travis, we get Machiste, we get Tara, we get Mariah, we get Shakira. No mention of Jennifer, though, which I thought was a little weird. And basically, Skartaris is in the middle of a major war that Travis's people are losing against this tyrant Rex. And he's got magic powers. He's got dinosaur men, which is part of why Travis's forces are reduced to basically being rebels and freedom fighters versus, you know, the opposing army anymore. So we get a couple of twists and turns on the story. Obviously, Batman and Superman have to play in. I would say, though, it was as much a Robin story as anything else.
Interesting. Okay.
Because Robin's the one that really interacts with Travis and his crew while Batman and Superman are off dealing with some other aspects of the story.
Okay. All right.
Now, if you remember Warlord Annual number 4, there was that two-page map of Skartaris.
Yes, I remember that.
In one of these issues, Travis has a map that's very, very, very similar to it.
Oh, nice. Nice. A callback.
Yeah, I thought that was a great callback.
All right.
And we get a nice bit at the end where really I think Robin kind of does the deciding thing that helps save the day. And it was a fun story. I don't want to ruin it. I think you would enjoy it. Unsurprisingly, Mark Waid is familiar with the Warlord, with Skartaris, all that stuff. He knows how to write that kind of a story. That said, while the story is very much set in Skartaris and has the Warlord and other characters, it's not a Warlord story. It's a Batman, Superman, World's Finest. Superman and Batman play key aspects in the story. I think it was one that really featured Robin more so than some of the other arcs have.
Okay. All right.
So good, fun, three-issue story. I thought it was a fun thing to do now that we've finished recording the Warlord Spotlights. We still have a few more to release at this point.
Yeah, but we've read them all.
But we've read them all. We've recorded them all. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. If you're going to have to see Skitaris with superheroes, it seems like that's the only kind of Warlord we're going to get. There you are. At least you got to go up to the world.
Yeah. Well, and that's the most recent version of them using Skitaris. The first one, I think, that happened after the Warlord series was over in Green Arrow by Mark Grell.
And that makes sense.
Oliver Queen meeting Travis in the Earth side of things.
In Green Arrow, in my opinion, makes a lot more sense.
Oh, yeah.
Like Superman or anything like that, or Wonder Woman or whoever. Because of the bow and arrow, he fits in.
Exactly. Ollie would fit in Skitaris minus the costume.
Exactly. And you could have something happen where he has to get a change of clothes because something happened, you know, a fight with a dinosaur. Who knows?
Or he didn't have his costume with him at the time or whatever. As long as you put him in something green and vaguely Robin Hoodish, you're good.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like a callback to his old uniform, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I like that.
So yeah, they did some fun stuff. It's, like I said, just the three issues. It's worth reading, I think, if you're into the Warlord, which I know you are.
I am into the Warlord, so now I want to read it.
Yeah.
All right. Over to me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to give you some weird picks on things I read, but there's a reason why I read it. Okay. I read Hyde Street 10 and 11. You're like, why is that weird? Okay. 10 and 11 were from months and months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I got these two issues from Cowabunga in August. And it was in my last shipment from Cowabunga Comics. They don't do the mail order. And I said, okay, I know these were old. I kind of left the series anyways. And the reason why I left the series, I was like, eh, it's okay, you know, but there's a few things that started to get a little bit weird. And I thought 11 was a much better issue than issue 10, in my opinion, when I read them back to back. So issue 10, you're getting the background on one of the characters on Hyde Street known as Sisterhood. Like two different words, not Sisterhood, but Sisterhood. And she ran a tarot card business in the 1920s. She's scamming people who are vulnerable. You know, stuff happens in life. People turn to people with strange powers to help them. And her powers and her story, in my opinion, are the least interesting of the characters on Hyde Street. I've never liked her. I didn't like the Sisterhood spinoff. So I was like, eh, it's okay. It's a background on her. But if you're a fan of that character, that's the issue for you. So then we moved on to issue 11, where we focus on the young Boy Scout who is named Pranky, who at this time had had a wolf mask stuck on his face. Like literally, it looks like a little werewolf, but it's stuck on his face. He can't get it off.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that happened in a previous issue. And you get the background and origin of Pranky. And I thought it was brilliant because I like this character. Pranky just seems like the most annoying, most depraved and deranged child you've ever met. But then when you get to learn about the character, he was a child of a war hero father, white father, and a Japanese mother. And this is going back to like World War II times. And we all know how World War II, the internment camps and things like that. So the mom was taken away while she was pregnant into an internment camp. And it ends up being a brutal origin story. And I don't want to go into details about stuff that happened in there because I don't want to ruin it. But I think the telling of it and the brutality of the story, it humanized the character a little bit to where you saw where this pent-up anger and this disdain for certain people and things that happen in the story, you get to see why maybe he is the way he is. It doesn't mean you sympathize with him, but you understand him.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I really liked it because I was able to connect with someone who I didn't connect with, even though I was like, oh, this is a very devious character. So I thought it was just purely a fantastically written issue. It was dealing with evil on different levels and humanization at the same time. It was like an A-plus story. Knocked it out of the park.
Cool. It's good to hear.
So kind of fun. But all that said, I was like, oh, I'm excited. Maybe I'll get caught up on Hyde Street. It's no longer on Global Comics. So it's like, well, whatever. So it's kind of in the abyss. So I probably will have to do the library where you get your library membership and you get free comics, but you have to wait for the trades, essentially.
Check Humble Bundle.
Humble Bundle.
I thought they were doing, and I don't know if it's still going or not, a Image thing that might have included, I don't know if it had a Hyde Street or not, but it had a number of creator-owned things from Image.
Okay, I'm going to check it out. Humble Bundle is a pretty amazing because they come out with just some insanely good deals from time to time.
Yes, there's some of the stuff, $18-$25, you can get an incredible amount of material.
It's not just comics, it's novels, it's all kinds of stuff. It's video games, it's teaching series, things that cost a lot of money, and you can get it for pennies on the dollar, and it's given to charity, most of it. So I think it's awesome what they do.
I like it because they got a lot of tech books. They've also had audiobooks at times.
Yeah.
They do book bundles, they do game bundles, and they do, yeah.
There's like different things, and you pick which one you want, or you can do all of them.
Well, they offer different ones at different times.
Correct.
So if you're into comics, or you're into tech books, or you're into audiobooks, if look at what they've got. They've got a smattering of things. If any of them look interesting, sign up for the email list.
Yeah.
Because then periodically you'll get an email of, hey, this thing's going to go live. It's going to be up for 2-3 weeks or whatever, maybe a month, maybe less. And for this price, you can get a subset of it, kind of the core material. And usually it's not more than like $18 or $25, and you get everything that's in the bundle.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's well worth it.
Oh, yeah. I have gotten a ton of things over the years that way. They've had different audiobooks for like the Doctor Who stuff.
Yep.
They've had a ton of tech books on Python programming or AI and stuff like that. And also periodically, they have a ton of comics in usually, I think, PDF format. But they've also had a couple of things where they've got like a lot of role-playing game supplements.
Oh, role-playing games. All right. Very cool.
I'd gotten a lot of the Star Trek Adventure stuff, a lot of the Doctor Who Adventure stuff. And the way it works is a content provider, a publisher, whatever, says, you know, hey, we've got this material. Let's do a bundle. And it is going to support a given charity.
Okay.
Now, when you do the purchase, my recommendation is to go to the adjust amounts, because some money goes to the content provider, which makes sense. They've provided the content.
Yes.
Some goes to the charity and some goes to Humble Bundle because, well, they're facilitating all this. They need to make some money.
Yes.
What I personally do, and obviously everybody should do what they feel is right, is I set the sliders such that I've minimized the Humble Bundle amount. Because even out of an $18 or $25 stuff, it's still around $5-6 sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you're covering your costs. You've clearly set it to what you need to break even, make a little money, and stay in business. I'm good with that. That's fair. I have no problem. But then I even out the remaining amount between the content provider, so they're encouraged to keep doing it, and the charity, so they get as much as seems reasonable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I like that. It makes sense.
But if you want to slide the things to where the charity gets the most you can give it and the others get the minimum, you can do that too.
Yeah. And I like that they give you that option, because that is kind of cool. When you check out, you can slide them around and do things. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. I've gotten, again, a number of things over the years from it. And I thought I had seen one that included, it might have included some of the early Geiger stuff from a few years back. I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head exactly what's in it.
Okay.
And I don't even remember if it's one of the ones I'd gotten or not. With those things, I've got a folder where I keep all the Humble Bundle things I've gotten, and I've gotten literally dozens over the years. And it's like, if I want to go listen to a Big Finish audio for Doctor Who, I'll check to see if I've already got it there.
Very cool. I like that.
It's a great way to support charity, support the content providers, and get just a hell of a deal on stuff.
Yeah. I'm honestly always amazed when I go in there, and it's a lot of times forgetting to go there and check it out. So I'm happy that when people share things on the Slack channel, we'll talk about a novel series or something. I'll be like, by the way, here it is on Humble Bundle. And you're like, oh my gosh, there it is.
But that's why I recommend getting on the email list.
Yes, 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 yes.
They do game bundles, book bundles, and software bundles. That's what it is.
Yep.
And I am checking right now. And normally I don't hop online to check stuff while we record, but I want to see if that image thing is still going or not. And
yeah, I'm curious, because if it is, as soon as we're done recording, I will be on there purchasing. I see one called Image in the 20s. I don't know if that's it.
That's the one.
Okay. I did search for Image. Image in the 20s, the entire 70 thing bundle. There's things like Adventure Man, the Sword of Crisis events. I remember you had read that. There's a ton of stuff in there.
Yeah, there's that's the one I was talking about.
Exquisite Corpses. Yeah, I remember. I like that. Yep. I'm looking at it right now. Free Planet, Gold Crate. There's just a ton of stuff. Plastic, which I know people like that. That Texas Blood. Man, there's a ton of stuff.
Blood Squad 7, 3 volumes of that. Dead Lucky.
Yeah.
A ton of things. The Forged.
So you can go in there and say, maybe I'll like these 4 or 5 things, but you can get them all and maybe find something that you wouldn't have read otherwise and find out you enjoyed it, which is kind of cool.
They've got Geiger's volume 1, 2, 3, and 4 of the trades.
Wow. That's a lot of content.
Yeah.
And I love Geiger. as you know.
So like I said, this is the sort of thing to do, and they allow you to put in however many dollars you want. If you go below 18 or 25, it's different for different bundles. Check to make sure you're still getting everything out of the bundle you want, and you haven't kind of, I don't say underbid, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, if you pick like $5, they'll drop you down and say, here's the 6 items you'll get versus the 70.
Yep.
And you'd be like, oh, okay, well, I want the $15, so you only get 17. For the 70, you have to bid at least $25.
And they always tell you, you've got to pay this much to get everything.
Yeah. And if you want to do more, you can. It's up to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So great thing. Cool. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So is it going to you now?
Yes.
All right. I forgot where we were.
You were just finishing up the Hyde Street stuff.
All right. All right.
I'm going to go with Captain America 6 through 11.
Oh, yeah. You were telling me you're going to dip into Captain America. What'd you think of it?
First off, it took a while for the Marvel app to finally get enough for me to read the next arc.
Okay.
This is the Doom's Shadow arc. It is kind of, sort of, but not quite a sequel to the first arc that was set back around the time when Steve had gotten out of the ice and was, you know, Captain America meeting the Avengers and stuff. He hadn't joined the Avengers at that point. This is now set in the present day, so he's obviously joined the Avengers long since. And it's got Nick Fury Jr. restarting up S.H.I.E.L.D. again, but this time is like a small mission-based thing, so no big entity that can be derailed or what have you. And it's all about the uncertainty in Latveria with Doom no longer there based on all the stuff that's gone on with the One World Under Doom and all the fallout from all of that stuff.
Okay.
None of which I've read.
Yeah, okay. I read that back in the day.
Yeah, again, I hadn't read any of that, so I didn't have all the context. It didn't matter. It was not really about the Doom side of it, more the Latveria side of it.
Yeah.
And how different factions, it's a power vacuum. They're trying to get in and seize power and what have you.
Yeah. One World Under Doom was skippable. There were some good things, but overall it's like, eh, okay.
Yeah. What got me is I was excited about this arc because I thought about this time last year, they were pitching it as there were going to be super soldiers of other countries there.
Mm, okay.
So we'd see like the French version of a Captain America-ish kind of guy or whatever. Not necessarily France, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And we got some members of the S.H.I.E.L.D. team that Fury's putting together, but none of which felt like they were particularly that nation's Captain America in any way, shape, or form.
Okay.
So it felt like a little bit of a bait and switch in that regard.
That's unfortunate.
And I'd need to go dig up the, I don't know if it was just the in-house ad pages or editorial type pages that were kind of leading me down that path or what, to see, did I just misinterpret or did they mislead?
Okay. All right. Interesting. Interesting.
I got the entire arc, all 6 parts, to the nominal end of Doom's Shadow arc. But what I didn't get was an end of the story.
Oh, okay. All right.
It leads into the next. And this whole thing is who's going to take over this of Latveria, all of these things. And we get a little of the Thunderbolt Ross, Red Hulk in here. We get a couple of characters that are introduced to no real effect. Maybe they'll be used somewhere else. I don't know. And one or two things that they did near the end where it's like, yeah, you overplayed your hand, Chip Zdarsky.
Mm.
There are very, very few writers who would be able to actually do what you claim to have done. And even any of those wouldn't be able to get away with it either.
Wow.
I mean, there are just certain things that aren't going to stay certain ways in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. I remember I was getting Captain America, and I think it was right around the end of the first arc I canceled it because I wasn't enjoying it.
That was also around the time where the mail order stuff stopped for us.
Oh, yeah. And I was like, probably thinking, this isn't that great anyways. Move on. I'll read it digitally, and I never went back.
And that's where I was at. If they hadn't had the pitch of more super soldiers forming an international team or whatever, I honestly would have skipped this arc.
Yeah.
And I think I should have.
Yeah, you should have. You regret spending that time on those issues.
It was not the best use of that time at the very least. It was unimpressive.
Well, that's unfortunate.
So, and they introduce a few characters that it's like, okay, you've got this Alina character who's trying to come to power over there. We've got a few others that one looks like it's just another Doom kind of a guy and a brother-sister team and stuff like that. It just because we got to have different forces vying for Latveria. And I've read enough stuff with Latveria over the decades this didn't run counter to it, but it didn't make me think, oh yes, this is of course how things would have gone in Latveria if Doom had left. Because the reality is there have been many times Doom is gone out of the picture and Latveria hasn't just crumbled in his absence.
Yeah, it's true. Multiple times.
Yeah, not an arc I would necessarily recommend. So
that's unfortunate, but I remember I wasn't enjoying the first arc either. So it makes sense. It kind of tracks. Yeah.
Well, and for them to jump forward to the present day so they could do a little bit of a callback to it. And even the callback, I didn't feel really had the payoff it could have or should have.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Okay, so over to me?
Yeah, what do you got?
Okay, I'm going to go back to a tried and true. I read two issues of Feral. I got Feral 24 and 25 that I read. And I will say, first of all, this series is awesome. And I thought 24 was another great issue. And there was one big ding against it, which I'll get to in a bit. But you get the whole Feral crew and the Stray Dogs story. It's still in the flip book format, essentially. And the animals are on the loose. The cats find a room full of the infected. The dogs find a room where dead dogs are being incinerated. They see people throwing dead dogs into literally incineration machine. And the CDC was testing a vaccine. That's essentially what's happening at this point. And the big catch for this, which is leading up to essentially the anniversary issue, is there's like something given that we found the cure. Something that, oh, we can fix this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the knock against this comic was issue 24 was the only issue where they didn't have at the back the pictures of like the animals that all of the cats and dogs, mostly cats, as almost all cats, that people send in. And so I was like, son of a gun, you left it out. But it did come back for issue 25. So I was happy about that. And 25, I felt was like the big dramatic issue because it's funny. They call them anniversaries. I'm like, shouldn't the anniversary be 24 for 2 years? But 25 is an anniversary. But you get the huge break.
It's a round number. It should be 12, 24, 36.
Exactly. But we call it leading up to 100.
It should be more like 8 or 10, depending how late they're running on some titles.
That is true. Very true. But I felt like 25 was the dramatic issue. It was a huge breakout. Hey, the cats and the dogs are teaming up. They kind of run into each other in the same room. They're all hissing, growling at each other. And they do something in the story. And I'm not going to say who and how that is able to get the dogs and cats communicating to each other. An intermediary, if you want to say. And I thought that was kind of clever how they did that and the way they did it. It was kind of cool. So you basically have humans in biohazard suits chasing after these animals who are running all over this clinic trying to escape, and a fire has broken out at this point. So there's a fire, the animals that are infected get out of their room. So all chaos, all hell's breaking loose. And the one thing I will say, George R. R. Martin, the writer, he has no problem killing off characters. And Kirkman, as we know, had no problem killing off characters inside of Walking Dead and things like that. I'm not saying that happens here, but there's levels of stress and chaos, and it leads to a point, can everyone be saved? Can this all be a happy ending for everyone? And there's cliffhangers in there, there's drama, there's high stakes, and you're just left with like a gut punch, and wow, that was a heck of an issue, and I want more, but that's the end of an arc, so now I got to wait probably 2 months. Or however long to read it, you know?
Right, right.
But honestly, it was a heck of an issue. I thought it was really terrific. Two thumbs up to Tony Fleeks, and he is still killing it. And someone asked me, it was someone on the Slack, I can't remember for the life of me. They're like, what issue were your cats in there? I'm like, he hasn't put my cats in yet, which is why I keep going. And I will pick these up because I'm looking for my cats, but they're not in there yet. That's why I keep picking up that comic. From a local shop.
And why you were annoyed the one issue didn't have.
Yeah, it's like, is that the one that my cats were supposed to be in? You son of a gun.
Yeah.
But it's ingenious because if you took the time to send in the picture to your cats and you're seeing them doled out over time,
mm-hmm.
You're invested because you want to see, and I'm going to save that issue. This is my cats. Oh my gosh. Look at them.
Yeah, it's a great way to get reader engagement.
Yeah, so terrific marketing. Yeah, I thought it was great. Great issue. Yeah.
Cool.
So what is your next one?
My next one was going to be Supergirl 11 to 14, which is the Reign of Superboy arc of the Heroes of Kandor.
But it's no longer going to be that.
Because I realized I hadn't read any of the Supergirl series. So I'm going to cover 1 through 14.
Oh, okay. All right. Wow, that's a big chunk.
It is a big chunk.
That's the bulk of what you read.
Actually, I think it went up to 15, actually, not 14. Wow. My bad. And This title, I honestly don't know really what they were thinking with this.
Really?
The first page of number one has Princess Shark.
Okay.
A humanoid shark wearing what looks like an octopus as a dress.
Okay.
Metropolis will soon become Sharkopolis. It is inevitable. And of course, Supergirl, you know, in the span of a panel or two, knocks her out and is about to throw her back to sea.
Yeah, it just seems kind of silly.
Yeah. The art style here is a little cartoony.
Okay.
Arguably a little, not quite manga-ish, but you know how they're doing those all-ages graphic novel type things?
Yes.
I kind of like to think of those as like outreach books of trying to outreach to more readers. This felt more like that than an in-continuity book.
Oh, that's not good, in my opinion.
I agree with that. Now, maybe it was just the coloring, but Crypto looked yellow.
Okay.
Not white. And I'm like, well, wait a sec. Crypto's supposed to be a white dog. This isn't the Crypto I'm expecting. And we get a few other things that, while I feel this isn't what I was expecting out of a Supergirl title, there are things that clearly indicate that the writer here, which is Sophie Campbell, I believe.
Okay.
Is very well versed in Supergirl lore. She's not only mentioning the bottled city of Kandor, but the yellow ring of Nor-Kan, which is something back from the Silver Bronze Age, which would allow a Kryptonian to maintain yellow sun powers in a non-yellow sun environment like the bottled city of Kandor. They mention Dick Malvern, which was Supergirl's Silver Age boyfriend. He's since died, so he's not in the picture. We get a lot with the Linda Danvers identity, even mentioning that she had worked on a soap opera as a, I forget if it was a camera person or what.
Okay.
We get the mention of the hollow tree where she had stored some stuff back when she was early days Supergirl. So there's a lot of things that are indicative of a wealth of knowledge of the character. Yet I still felt the character was almost more based on the TV show Supergirl than the comic book Supergirl.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, part of that is they've decided to have the Danvers be the Danvers from the show, not the classic ones from the comic, which not like anybody would remember the classic ones from the comic anyway. So I don't think that's a huge deal. But again, it's a little bit of a shift. They're even mentioning the special comb Supergirl had that she could comb her hair to be brown as Linda Danvers and her natural yellow as Supergirl.
Wow.
So again, some really deep cuts on some of the stuff that hadn't been dealt with in years or decades in some cases. And we get a couple of things. A lot of these are, I can't say done in one stories, but one issue stories.
Okay.
Where there's definitely carryover from issue to issue. On paper, it would seem like it's that never ending storytelling approach that I keep clamoring for, but it's not. Because really what's happening is every issue is ending on a hook for the next. Like they've started the next issue just a little early to entice you to read it. And as I was going through this, I mean, 15 issues is a fair amount. And it's like, oh, I'll find a good natural stopping point and I'll just pause. I'll go grab a bite to eat it, you know, whatever. And there wasn't one.
Wow.
It was written as if it were a run-on sentence.
Oh my God. That seems exhausting.
It was.
So you come out of it just feeling beaten down. Oh man.
Give me a breathing point. Give me a pausing point or something like that.
Yeah. Like a natural place to stop at which you put your little bookmarker in or you finish the issue and then you pick it up later. Nobody wants to just sit through everything.
Yeah. And the whole thing reeked of the writer having done, I think, solid research, but then doing some Easter eggs isn't quite the right term, but like, I think it was the last page of the first issue. Linda Danvers comes down the stairs of the Danvers house in Midvale wearing one of the outfits from the Silver Age.
Okay.
By today's standard, does feel a little dated, but they're also trying to balance, okay, when Supergirl was in Midvale, she went by Linda Danvers. She's going by Kara now because that's what she was going by in the show. So trying to balance all of those things. And there are a lot of Silver Age sort of plots thrown at it. The mistaken identity. We've got a growing supporting cast. One of them is Lesla Lar, who's from Kandor. And she, at one point, is using black kryptonite for some stuff. Because one of the other things is this author seems to think that kryptonite should come in every shade of the rainbow.
Oh, all right.
We get Black Kryptonite, which again is from TV shows, more so I would say Smallville than Supergirl. But we get Turquoise Kryptonite, we get Pink Kryptonite. Trying to think if we get red. We get too many colors.
Almost like they're doing the Lantern Rings with Kryptonite, essentially.
You could argue that they had done that before the Lantern Rings, but
okay.
There were still only about a half dozen different types.
Wow.
In the Silver and Bronze Age.
But now it's just out of control.
Okay. This, to me, reeks of All-Star Superman rearing its head, because there was a bit there where Grant Morrison had Pink Kryptonite, and while he didn't flat out say it, the effect it had on Superman was arguably very cliche and gendered.
Oh, okay. All right. I can kind of guess. All right.
Not only do we get Lesla Lar as part of the supporting character, we get Lena Luthor, which is the daughter of Lex Luthor in this reality, and was a recurring character. I think it was the sister of Lex in the show.
Okay.
We also wind up getting another character who has the LL initials. And that, again, was a Silver Age trope. Lightning Lad, Lana Lang, Lois Lane, Lori Lamaris, that kind of deal.
Okay.
And it was Luna Lustrum was the other character. We also get the super pets. We've got Crypto. We've got Streaky. Lesla Lar brings in her bunny from Kandor, and it goes by the name Candy with a K for Kandor. So we've got a super bunny now, as if we need that. We also wind up with Titano, who winds up getting shrunken down by Lena. We get just a ton of things, and it feels roller coaster ride-ish.
Yeah.
And other points where it's like, okay, they're dealing with Supergirl's old costume, so there's almost a fashion show sort of montage. Again, kind of like we got in the Silver Age.
Interesting.
I couldn't tell where they were going with this, why they were going with this. And I'm not even sure the writer really knew, because we got one point where, I think it was issue 5, they interrupt the Supergirl series for a Super Pets issue. And it's like, okay, why? And that ends with Supergirl collapsing for no known reason, and that motivates the next story. We even get a mention of her having been a Red Lantern. We later on get a Thanksgiving dinner where, and this part really confused me, the guests that the Danvers have include Superman and Lois.
That's funny.
Because I guess Clark showing up would have given away his identity, but Superman coming with Clark's wife doesn't.
That's hilarious.
After that, we get an issue of a forgotten Supergirl robot almost trying to get revenge on Supergirl for having abandoned her. And that story just kind of fizzles at the end. We get Periwinkle Kryptonite after that. We get the point where it kind of jumps over the DC KO. Connor, that Superboy, comes in sort of at the end of one issue, but isn't there at the beginning of the next. And that's where the Reign of the Superboy story kind of starts. Again, if you're going to start the Reign of the Superboy story, you would think, since you've already brought Superboy into the title, you might use him at the start of that, but you don't.
Okay.
So we introduce a new villainous threat of Black Flame, and she's got this connection to another character. And that part of the story is taking place in Kandor. Supergirl at this point doesn't have her powers. She gets badly hurt, and one of the people who finds her basically does the Celaya Stone routine of turning her into a cyborg.
Interesting.
So she's got that for a little bit until Handwave, she's back to normal before the end of the arc. Very bizarre.
It sounds horrible, honestly.
Remember the arc in Batman's Superman that had Kid Thunder or whatever it was?
Yeah, I remember that.
He gets referenced in here.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, the Kandorians have taken DNA samples and made clones. They made 3. So they've got subjects 1, 2, and 3 that turn out to be Thunder Girl, Thunder Kid, and Thunder Lad. I guess they're going to grow up to be Legionnaires or something. But they're cloned from Boy Thunder and have similar powers. So we've got a fight between this Black Flame, Supergirl and her friends, and these Thunder clones. And it's just all over the map. And at one point, they reference Argo City having crash-landed into the ocean in Supergirl, quote-unquote, Volume 1, those are my quotes, Reign of the Cyborg Superman. Now, There was a bit when we get into, I forget if it's one of the Danvers offices or if it was in Kandor, but in the background, there's references to Supergirl volume 1 through 17.
Okay.
I haven't checked how many volumes Supergirl has had as comics, but it feels like about that many.
Wow.
So when you tell me you're referencing something from Supergirl volume 1, Reign of the Cyborg Superman, that doesn't tell me enough to go look up where that story is.
You don't want to go digging to find it.
Well, because how many volume 1 of Supergirl trades have there been?
Tons. Yeah.
So it was all over the place, and it kind of ended these 15 issues with Supergirl having formed a team that they're calling, I guess, Super Force, that has, I think it is Thunder Girl, Princess Shark, Luna Lustrum, Lena Luthor, and I'm not sure who else.
To your point about not looking it up, and maybe for some reason my mind triggered, I think it was Rocket Raccoon had 2 number one issues to 2 different series in the same year.
Yep, Superboy had that once too.
And you're just like, how do you reference 1A, 1B? I'm just like, the things these companies do, insane.
The way I do it is, you've got the title, so Superboy, Supergirl, whatever. I reference it by the year the first issue was released.
Oh, okay.
So in 1 year, Superboy had a title that started with a number one at the start of 2011 and at the end of 2011. So right now we've got Superboy 2011 number one, but we got another Superboy 2011 number one. So I wound up in my stuff, it's 2011B for the second volume.
Yeah. Just insanity, the hoops you have to jump through because of the things that go on at Marvel and DC.
Yeah. And it makes a footnote useless of you're telling me it's volume one of some collection. So when you renumber your collections every time the wind changes and they're all number ones, what the hell? We also got a reference to the sun crystal from El Cadero or whatever that was in the first arc of Superman Unlimited, I think it was.
Okay.
One of the other recurring themes here in these 15 issues is Lena giving Supergirl, at first, a new costume, very similar to the one Brainiac 5 gave Supergirl in the show, where it just kind of morphs out of the S emblem or some such. So Supergirl gets one of those. She then gets a revised one that was an anti-kryptonite suit that has a dial so you can customize it to which color of kryptonite.
Oh.
And if that doesn't reek of they've got too many colors here, I don't know what does. But then Lena gave her another one that is a S-matrix suit out of a super substance she'd been toying with, which not only heals Supergirl, but uncyborgs her from the cyborging she had done just an issue or two prior. And it's like, really? What's the point of half of this?
Yeah. What a mess.
So, again, the writer clearly knows the histories of Supergirl, and I say that plural because there have been a number.
But he just did some odd things with the character and the book.
Referencing it for the sake of showing off, I think. Too many colors of kryptonite, and just it is a nonstop barrage of, oh, you think you've caught up? Let me throw another thing at you. Just to, I feel, almost keep the reader off balance so they don't notice how chaotic the book is.
That's unfortunate, honestly. And you read a lot of issues to get there.
Yeah. And again, the art style, the art is not bad. I don't want anyone to think I dislike the art. But you know how like Todd Nauck and Humberto Ramos have a definite style to them?
Yes.
This has a style that to me feels this is, again, one of those outreach books versus it's an in-continuity DC Universe book.
Yeah.
I mean, it clearly is supposed to be an in-universe DC book. It's crossing over into the Reign of the Superboys and all of that.
But I know what you mean. The art's saying something different when you read it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Well, I was, for my book, I was going to talk about Geiger, but I'm not going to do that because you and I are going to jump into the unnamed universe later on and a long form read. So I will not tell you about Geiger and I will not tell you about Redcoat that I read, but I read Battle Beast and I'm going to say something really quick about that. I read 10 and 11 of Battle Beast. I felt like they were darn near perfect comics, but both issues were fight issues. So it was a long drawn out fight issues between a Viltrumite and Battle Beast. It was fun. Awesome. I loved it, but you can only talk about a fight over 2 issues in so many ways, but it was honestly fantastic. And it set up for issue 12 to be like a big end of an arc and also conclude the fight. So there's that. But what I was going to talk about was I read Conan the Barbarian number 32 and 33. And they were very different. So 32 was a done in one issue. Previously, they had dealt with a fight with a character called Son of the Tooth, who kind of was like a Highlander type, get powers from all the people he killed, the ultimate assassin, essentially. And what could Conan do to combat this? And anyways, we got to the conclusion of that, or did we? Because the way they did some stuff in there, you're like, huh, is there more here to be told? But Conan's on the mend. He's cared for by the people in this town, this tavern. He wakes up, they stitched him up, given him food, room and board, and he needs to repay him. So he takes a contract, essentially. Some strange woman comes in. He's going to escort her into the desert. There's animal battles, creature battles, and it all led up to a little bit of a womp womp letdown at the end. But it's tough to do a done in one right. I felt like it was a lot of action adventure, not a lot of payoff at the very end. So that was not a great issue, but it was okay. And then we got into 33, which once again, it wasn't a great issue for Jim Zub, in my opinion, because you go from this, okay, we're leaving the Son of the Tooth arc, which was a big thing. We're going to have this done in one issue. And then we jump into this issue, 33, and all of a sudden we're in a pirate ship with a whole crew of pirates and Valeria. And there's no explanation or rhyme or reason as to how he became a pirate, why they're on a pirate ship, why they're raiding other vessels. And there's a storm at sea, and the ship kind of crashes on a shore. And it seems like that whole thing was done as a plot device to move him to a different section of territory that he wants to tell a story there. But I felt a little bit frustrated because it's like, wait a minute, how did we meet up with Valeria? How did we get on a pirate ship? This doesn't make any sense.
It almost feels like you missed an issue. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like at 32, 33. And I don't know if something happened. Like I said, if I missed something, but in my notes, if I didn't type it wrong, I was like, I was reading it and I was just like, I went back and I looked. I was like, it was weird. It just changed. And so I don't know what happened. I don't know if Titan didn't release an issue, if I read something wrong, if I wrote down a wrong number, but I was confused a little bit. But it wasn't bad. It felt like we're doing this whole pirate ship thing literally to get from point A to point B because I want to tell a story about this section of the world. And so that was the letdown for me.
I can totally understand being let down by that. When they do that kind of jump between issues, whether it's intentional or not, it can be very jarring.
Exactly. Very jarring. And so it kind of lets you down. And I felt like Jim Zub, I don't want to say he was infallible, but you know, I've enjoyed everything he's written.
Mm-hmm.
And those last two issues were just kind of like, they're good-ish. You know, add the ish at the end. They're good-ish. They're really not great issues. I was a little bit disappointed.
Well, on the one hand, it's good that he's built up the goodwill with the readers and stuff to get through a bumpy issue or two. But it's bad after building up the goodwill with the readers to have a bumpy issue or two.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm going to give him some space because he's done such a good job up until now. So I wasn't upset or angry with the issue. It was just like, huh, that was a little bit of a letdown.
That's too bad, though.
Yeah. So I think that was our last ones, right?
That was your last one. I still got one left.
Oh, okay. All right. I went first. So yeah, what's your last one?
My last one is the Supervillain Rescue Project series of novels that are part of the DOSA universe, the Department of Superabled by H.L.
Yeah.
Burke.
Oh, yeah. You were reading those before. What'd you think? Which ones did you read?
This one had four books as part of it, Power On, Power Play, Power Through, and Power Up. And these are a different series from, but sort of a continuation of the Supervillain Rehabilitation Project.
Okay.
Which had five books and a short story to kick it off. The Supervillain Rehabilitation Project. And that one, the idea is if you can rehabilitate supervillains into superheroes, that's a win. It's easier and better than incarcerating them. Through the course of that, they met one or two kids and they realized, because the main villain they had rehabilitated, if he'd gotten on a better path at a younger age, they wouldn't have had to rehabilitate him. He could have been a hero from the get-go.
Yeah.
So the two lead characters of Prism and Fade from the Supervillain Rehabilitation Project, at the end of that, as part of around the time of the reunion, the final book of that series, they have moved from Carlsbad, California, or maybe it was Oceanside, one of the two, Oceanside, I guess it was, to somewhere, I think, in like Oregon. And they set up a camp for kids at risk with superpowers. So they take on three kids, and that's essentially kind of the arc of these kids going through a few years and growing up. And one of them, he's not a bad kid, but he accidentally set his apartment on fire because he's got fire powers and didn't know how to control them. And his mom's not really a good mom, and his dad's out of the picture.
Okay.
So that was one of the kids. Another one of them is the daughter of a hero. Her mom is definitely a power player within the, I don't say the political side of the Department of Super Abled, but on that side of it. So this kid is acting out. She gets in trouble, thrown out of a prep school or whatever. So to not get her reputation tarnished so she can't be a hero later, into the program she goes.
Okay.
And then there is a kid who had just been arrested from part of a major gang in the Southwest, and he winds up being kind of the third of the three kids. And the first book plays a little on the kid from the crime organization.
Yeah.
The next one on kind of the daughter of the other superhero. And then the last one on the kid with the fire powers and stuff. That's the third one, actually. The fourth one is kind of tying it all together and going back to the ramifications of the kid from the crime organization and stuff. And we get some of the politickings within the Department of Super Abled, because some of them wanted their claws into this kid from the villain organization because, well, that could get them resources to shut that thing down, etc. And there are enough ties to the supervillain rehabilitation project in the supervillain rescue project books, because Prism's brother shows up here and there. The later villain they recruited in the supervillain rehabilitation project with fire powers, he gets kind of looped in off screen of, hey, can you provide some training ideas for this kid with fire powers? He later becomes a key part of the story. And I think it was Power Through. I forget which of the four books.
Okay.
So we see a lot of those characters coming back.
Okay.
As kind of guest stars and that sort of a thing. So these four books are separate from those other five in a short story, but not divorced from either.
All right. Interesting.
It's telling stories in this case with the leads that are in their mid-teens. So it skews a little younger in terms of the decisions they make and some stuff like that.
Cool.
Now, there was one other kid who's in the project for a bit, and her powers were really, again, kind of out there. She had been the daughter of a supervillain. Her mother was apparently killed by the supervillain, and he goes on the run with the daughter.
Okay.
Something happens to the father. The daughter winds up at the camp. And when the daughter is around something that really engages her imagination, her power kicks in.
All right.
It's essentially to almost create a pocket dimension based on what she's imagining.
Oh, that's kind of cool. Almost like, well, not the same, but I like that. I was going to say the Richards kid, remember how he could create like dimensions and stuff like that? But different, but similar.
Exactly. It's not the same, but it's not radically different.
Yeah, so I like that.
Now, imagine you're running a camp for kids. You don't know if this kid has powers, much less what they are. And Prism, being a little bit of a sci-fi geek and whatnot.
Yeah.
Besides, a fun thing for the kids to do for the afternoon is play essentially a Dungeons & Dragons-like game.
Oh, my goodness.
She goes out of the room to go get some snacks. She comes back. The kids are gone. They've been sucked into that reality.
That's hilarious. That's awesome. Almost like the Jumanji game. Remember that? The
mm-hmm.
movie?
Exactly. Yeah. A lot like that.
Yeah, I love it.
But some of these kids, when they were filling out their character sheet, the one with the firepower, he goes all in. He's, my character's got this, that, and the other. Whereas the one from the crime family, he just put a couple of notes of, yeah, he's got a knife, he's got this, he's, you know, very bare bones.
Okay.
And they have to deal with those ramifications in the reality because all of those things are true.
Ah, okay.
And they can't tell the girl, they can't break the reality for her because they don't know what happens if that happens.
Okay.
Because there's two or three other people stuck in this realm and they're like, yeah, don't do that. It's really bad. When the reality fizzles out, we're just kind of in a void and limbo, and it's really hard on the psyche.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, that was one of the plot lines. So, I mean, these are a lot of fun. Some of these powers are very standard. Okay, you can control flame. Some of them are a lot more out there, like this reality bubble sort of a deal. I am continuing to enjoy these books by H.L. Burke. There's another group of them that I am starting with. I think it's the Supervillain Romance Project. Everything's a project with this writer for some reason. And there's, I think, five or six of those. I think these are a little shorter.
If it becomes popular enough, do you think it's something that they would look at adapting into like a comic? I'm just curious.
I don't know. And I'm not even sure if I would recommend they do that.
Okay. I was just curious on your take, you know, since it's like superhero type stuff. I don't know. But honestly, not everything needs to be a comic. Let it be its own thing.
It certainly could be adapted into a comic. I don't think there's any significant reason why not, other than it's written as a book, so you lose the voiceover and a few things like that. There'd be a few things that'd be a little tricky to translate.
Yeah.
But the whole supervillain thing, I think, lends itself to it. Likewise, they could probably, if they had a halfway decent budget, do it as a TV show or streaming series.
Oh, all right. Yeah, that'd be cool.
So
you've read a lot of these and they sound like fun books, and it just sounds like the writer's having fun and you're having fun reading them.
Yeah, because there was like 10 of the superhero romance project. There was the 5 and a short story for the supervillain rehabilitation project, which I think was what kicked the universe off.
Okay.
Because once I finished the superhero romance one, which was some of the, I think, the more current stuff, because I think the last of those came out while I was reading the series, I then circle back to the beginning. At least that was my intent, and I think I've successfully done this. So I think the supervillain rehabilitation project starts it, followed by the rescue project I'm doing, followed by, I'd have to double check if the supervillain legacy project came, and then they went into, again, the names of these are similar enough. So it's supervillain rehabilitation, supervillain rescue, supervillain romance, then I think it's supervillain legacy, and then I think it's the superhero romance project, but there's also a SVR Files book they did too, and some of those I think are short stories written by other people maybe, or no, those are the Dose of Files.
Okay.
Beyond the supervillain romance project stuff I've just started, which has like 6 books, there's 2 other 2-book series and then a 3-book anthology series. So it's fun stuff. These are easy reads, and I think the author does a good job defining the characters, making them likable. Certainly, the superhero romance project had a very much a Hallmark romance movie of the week kind of vibe to it in the right ways.
Well, that sounds really cool. I like that. And how many more books are the different series? Are you close to being done with them, or are there a lot more?
And I've got, again, the 6 of the supervillain romance project I just started, 2 more for supervillain legacy project, 2 more for the SRV Files book 1 and 2, and then the 3 Dose of Files anthologies.
Okay, so you'll probably have them. Most of them read by the next time we record a monthly comic spotlight.
I don't think the next one.
Maybe 2.
I'm averaging about a book a week.
Okay, so it'll be a couple. So
I might be done with the supervillain romance project because I think those are a little shorter for next monthly comic spotlight. And then depending how I'm doing on some other stuff, I might get the supervillain legacy project done after that for the following one. Possibly also the SRV files. I'm not sure. It just depends on some books read faster than others.
Yeah. True.
Because of the difference in length. I mean, there are a few of these, like the final one of the supervillain rehabilitation project was only 148 pages. There have been 1 or 2 of these that were 310 pages.
Oh, wow.
So there's definitely some difference in page length.
All right. Well, I'm glad you found them. It sounds like it's good stuff. And are they mostly on Kindle Unlimited?
All of them are Kindle Unlimited.
Okay, that's what I thought. All right, cool.
And cool. I've actually been picking some of them up as purchased copies.
Ah.
One of them was free for at least a day or two. And I was like, well, I'll grab that for nothing. And then I've been trying to put price alerts on the others. And as they drop to like a buck or two, I want to support the author. I think she's doing a really good job with this stuff.
All right. Very cool. That's nice of you. I like it.
I've read a number of novels that are superhero, at least adjacent, if not flat out superhero-ish.
Okay.
And in other words, they have superpowers, but maybe they're not crime fighters or whatever. And a lot of them don't understand the comic book superhero genre.
Yeah.
And there are some things where this universe just is fundamentally different. It's got a government-sponsored agency that you can become a hero through and all of that. So you don't really tend to have independent heroes. So it's, in that respect, fundamentally different than Marvel and DC universes. But once you get around a few things like that, and they can have secret identities, but they don't really focus on that. There's more almost the mistaken identity than the secret identity, if you will. Because that was a major thing in the final superhero romance project book I read, Dating the Supervillain's Daughter, where the daughter and the hero didn't know each other's relationship to the villain.
Interesting.
So it's more the mistaken identity than the secret identity kind of deal.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right.
And again, some of these are very blatant, shoot fire, energy blast, fly sort of powers. Others are very kind of off the wall, different approaches that I haven't seen in comics, yet make sense as superpowers in this world.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of cool that she can come up with things that are completely unique in her little world that she's created, essentially.
Yeah. If I were going to suggest one book to start for this, I would probably say Dating the Supervillain's Daughter.
Dating the Supervillain's Daughter. Okay.
I thought that was the best of the bunch, but there are a few others that are pretty good too.
All right. Cool. Well, man, that's kind of cool. I mean, it sounds like you had a blast reading them.
Yeah. Ton of fun.
Yeah.
Again, easy reads. They're page turners. And I'm not going to say everybody's going to love them. Some people might hate them or whatever because it's just not the sort of thing they want to read. But it's got, for the most part, what I would say kind of that hallmark sensibility of people are complex. People have their own foibles. They're trying to do the right thing or whatever, or they're villains and they're not. Yet it's not some of the angst-driven or superhero slugfests we tend to get out of the Marvel and DC movies these days.
Yeah, it gets old after a little while. I don't want to say it gets old, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's only so much CGI you can see before you're like, okay, I've seen this before. And I find myself, I'm changing as a person the older I get. Like, I can watch action and CGI and things like that, but I prefer something that makes you feel something when you're watching it.
Yeah.
I'm maturing as a person.
Well, and the other thing I think this writer, she does a very good job with is there is a history in this universe where things that happen in one book sometimes get referenced later to comedic effect or serious effect or whatever.
Okay.
Or characters show back up and they're clearly the same character. So it's got a cohesiveness to the universe without being mired in needless continuity.
Okay.
So it's not like you've got to have a footnote on, hey, this character showed up back in this book on this page, this chapter, because you need to read that to understand what's going on.
All right. That makes sense. I like that.
Because in the Supervillain Rehabilitation Project, Prism's brother undergoes a very rough period, and he shows up a little later in the Supervillain Rescue Project I just finished with the kids at the camp. And they kind of figured out that there's something that the adults aren't really talking about there. Why didn't the brother show up when Prism got married? Why wasn't he at the wedding? They're tight. They're close. Something had to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And that made perfect sense in the Supervillain Rehabilitation Project as to why he was not there, but not in a way that the author felt the need to footnote it, spell it out, or even explain it to the kids or the readers.
Okay.
So, and some of that is, I think, how people would have actually dealt with that situation had it happened.
Exactly. So,
again, I recommend the stuff. I'm looking forward to getting through the rest of it.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it. I don't want this to sound bad, but it sounded like you're having more fun reading that than a lot of the comics you read.
I think it's a better superhero universe than a lot of the comics I'm reading.
And that's where we stand today.
Yeah.
It's kind of eye-opening because when you're talking about it, I can hear the passion and enjoyment. Whereas when you're reading like the Supergirl stuff, you're just like, ugh. It didn't come off that way, but there was gripes and complaints about what was given to you and what you spent a lot of time reading versus this was pure joy and exploration. And there's so few comics that are like that. And that's sad.
There were aspects of the Supergirl title. I couldn't tell if they were making fun of her history or not.
Yeah. Are you respecting it or ha ha ha? And that's not good.
And again, pulling out any color of the rainbow kryptonite for comedic effect almost. Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
It felt like it was a breezy read in all the wrong ways, whereas I'm finding these Department of Super Abled books an easy read in all of the right ways.
Okay. All right. And I like an easy read that's enjoyable. That's the key. Easy read, yeah. Enjoyable. Yeah. You got me hooked and you make me happy.
Yeah. Anything else?
No, that does it for me.
Cool. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you liked this episode, please spread the word about the Comic Book Page podcast by telling your friends and posting a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And please, join our Slack community and let us know what you thought of this episode. I do this podcast because I enjoy talking about comics. So let's talk about comics. The show notes, form, and instructions for how to join our Slack channel can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. The opinions of the co-hosts and guests are their own. The Comic Book Page podcast is copyright John Mayall. And thanks again for listening.